From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on the streets of Rochester several weeks ago when thousands of people turned out to protest and to call for change in policing. It would be unfair to oversimplify exactly what demonstrators want. Polls show that most Americans of all backgrounds do not currently want to abolish police, but local civil rights leaders say they are working to change that. And polls show Black Americans have a range of views on police. A majority want to significantly cut police funding. A strong number also wants to expand and retrain police. So it's complicated. But it's fair to say that many, many people want change, durable, lasting change. And on this program, we've talked to civil rights activists. We've talked to members of Rochester City Council, which voted for a modest cut to police funding. We've talked to the president of the Rochester Police Union. Today we bring in leaders from United Christian Leadership Ministry, which has worked on the subject of police-community relations for years now. Our guests this hour include Reverend Lewis Stewart, the president of United Christian Leadership Ministry. Reverend, welcome back to the program.
Good afternoon, Evan.
Great to have you, and also great to have Alex White, co-chair of the United Christian Leadership Ministry Community Justice Advisory Board. Alex, welcome back to the program.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
And we're hoping to have Carrie Coleman. We'll try to connect with Carrie soon. Carrie's chair of community police relations for UCLM. Reverend, let me start with you and just ask, I'll ask both of you out of the gates here. What do you think we are seeing in the last several weeks that tells you that we are close to creating actual lasting change? And are we moving in the direction of what you think we should accomplish, what we need to accomplish, and what we can accomplish?
Well, I would say that what we have been seeing within the past month is a trajectory of what was started during the civil rights movement. And that in the civil rights movement at some point, it made changes, but it didn't go far enough. This is, I think, the third revolutionary phase of the civil rights movement in terms of advocating for police reform. And I think, Evan, as you well know, under the leadership of Reverend Graves of United Church Ministries, and then our organization, United Christian Leadership Ministry, we have been advocating for transparency and accountability for 3 or 4 decades now. Ever since the killings of Alicia McCullough, Calvin Green, Ken Jackson, and Denise Hawkins, and those deaths were in the late 60s and early 70s. So I am glad to see that the public is engaged in this conversation and buttressing what we have been advocating for years. I think it's a welcome change. And I think certainly police community relations bears a discussion. It bears a really transparent discussion on our vision of policing and where do we go from here and what are the solutions to such a complex community relations police situation.
Okay. Alex White, what do you think?
Well, I don't think we're actually near a tipping point yet. I think that there's been a tremendous amount of backlash against what happened at, for example, Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I think that for the most part, there's a lot of people who are very fearful because of the cry of defund the police. And, you know, the institutions of government and of police are also not willing to admit they need to change yet.
Let's expand on that, Alex. You say we're not near a tipping point, which I guess maybe elaborate on what you think it would take to get there and what a tipping point would actually bring.
Well, you know, the United Christian Leadership Ministry is calling for a lot of things, but one of the things I want to concentrate on that they're calling for is for a change in policing to more de-escalation. And I don't think that is, A, well understood. I don't think the public has a real knowledge of what's being called for there yet. And I know that the police departments are basically dismissing it out of hand still.
Well, okay. So let me ask both of you then. Let's let's try to be as specific as we can as we go throughout the hour about what the organization wants to see happen, what that would look like in practice. And Alex, you bring up de-escalation, so we'll start there. So Alex, de-escalation is something that a lot of police departments do get trained in. Now, I'm sure the training has different flavors, but do you feel like it has not borne nearly enough fruit, or do you feel like departments are not serious about it? What's the actual goal with de-escalation as you see it?
Well, first, I mean, here in Rochester, I believe they spend 4 hours in de-escalation training out of their 26 weeks. And, you know, most of that 26 weeks is spent on use of force. So they've got hundreds of hours on use of force and 4 hours on de-escalation. Just unlikely that that's ever going to happen. Now, I think of and I guess there was a new case in Baltimore where an officer talked a guy to put his knife down and not commit suicide by cop. But I always think of the vacationing Swedish police officers who stop a knife fight on the subway and convince the two people to sit quietly, you know, and be arrested. De-escalation training does work in other countries really well, and even when brought here, it works. And, you know, the idea that lots of our situations could be handled differently and get more positive results just is without question. So, but I think that, you know, in many cases, this is something that's too new to the public, and the public is not ready to embrace something they don't understand, and we're not going to have it until the public's ready.
Okay, Reverend Stewart, what do you think?
Yes, I agree with Alex. We agree on that, basically, because there's been certainly a lot of pushback relative to police reform, and certainly some of the police agencies around the country and possibly here have been willing to put the brakes on certain things, although they do engage with us in terms of conversation. But specifically, UCLM has always touted the issue that we're not for this so-called, quote-unquote, defunding of the police because it's a poor definition. It's a poor definition because it's nebulous, it's vague, and what does it point to? So what we advocate for are the reallocation of resources. And we support the reallocation of resources to more specific things relative to police training and community police relations. So let me give you a few examples, Evan. One of the things is we would like to see all police departments engage in racial justice and education training, which would be different than diversity training, which would be different than implicit bias training. What needs to be done is we need to change the whole culture of policing, and that this type of training would be mandated for all officers at least twice a year. Then the second thing we've been advocating is the implementation of a community public safety panel. And what that would do is the community public safety panel would get together 3 to 5 citizens who've been trained in interviewing techniques, et cetera, to sit down and interview police candidates and recommend to those in authority whether or not they should be hired as police officers. Now, this is what we would call true community policing. Then a third thing would be a mandated mental health evaluation annually so that we can flag those officers who are under stress so they can get therapeutic help because we do know officers who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder or syndrome, sometimes will take out their frustrations on members in the community in terms of excessive force. So we do know that applicants for police hired as police need to pass two tests or several tests. One certainly is a psychological eval, but that psychological eval is given at the inception and not carried on a yearly basis. And so we're saying that it needs to be carried on at a yearly basis. Now, that's going to cost some money. So we look at allocating some financial resources to that. And then the third thing is the fourth thing is that the governor's reform and the repeal of 50A is good. We've been advocating that for a long time. But the executive order relative to an independent investigator does not go far enough. Now, according to the governor's executive order, that independent investigator would only investigate incidents relative to police shootings that end in a fatality or something like that. We're advocating that this should be expanded to include police officers who have engaged in excessive force and abuse of citizens, because we do not really believe that the district attorney's office is able to handle this independently. And so we need an independent investigator to handle these things. So police reform means many things to many people. But to us, it means accountability and transparency. It means really making those reforms that are necessary so that we can have a fairness and non-racist behavior relative to police.
Reverend Stewart, City Council voted 8-1 in favor of the recent budget that cut police funding by about 4%. What did you make of that vote?
Well, for me, the question is, okay, they took out the school resource officers, which I am for. Police never needed to be in schools in the first place. So the question for me is, what is that money going to be used towards? And we hope that that money will be expanded and used towards more comprehensive and better training relative to the police. I think it's an idea whose time has come, and so let's reinvest that money in terms of better policing. We need to have a vision of what we look at policing as being like. I think in the past and now, police see themselves as warriors. Now, according to President Obama's 21st Century Task Force on Policing, police need to see themselves as guardians and as protectors of the community and not as warriors. And so we need to look at policing and envision it in a different way in this 21st century.
Let me play a little bit of sound for our guests to respond to. This is member of Rochester City Council, Willie Lightfoot, on this program this past Friday. Now, he's responding in the clip you're about to hear. He's responding to comments from local civil rights activists who have called for abolishing police after saying that police are killing black people. Here is Councilmember Lightfoot.
I'm totally connected to what's going on in our community. And I would say to make a statement that the police department are all killing people, I think is disrespectful to a lot of the men and women who put on that uniform, who do the job right every day, to paint a broad brush that every police officer is killing people or disrespecting people or doing people wrong is just plain outright wrong.
Councilmember Lightfoot, do you want to see an eventual abolition of police?
Absolutely not. The most people, I'm here on Jefferson Avenue right now, the most people who need the police is people of color.
That's Willie Lightfoot, Vice President of Rochester City Council. His views, by the way, are, I think they track pretty closely to where Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren is on this. And let me ask all three of our guests, because I think we've got Kerry Coleman with us now. Reverend Stewart, I'll start with you. What did you make of what you heard from Vice President Lightfoot there?
Listen, Vice President Lightfoot, he has his ear to the streets. He knows what's happening. If anyone needs the police in the community, it's certainly people of color, poor, black and brown people, especially. What we do not want is the police shooting us. We do not want the police treating us with disrespect. We do not want the police doing things that are going to arouse our ire. So certainly, I agree a lot with what Vice President Willie Lightfoot has said. A lot of the police are not engaging in shooting and killing people. But the fact is, police still can be trained in a way to handle situations much better than some have been handling it in the past, such as the arrest of the 10-year-old girl. I think that should have been handled in a much better way. Certainly what happened to Christopher Pate and Brenda Hardaway and Ricky Bryan and others certainly could have been handled in non-biased and non-threatening ways. and certainly more training is needed in this particular area.
All right. Alex White, what did you make of what you heard from Willie Lightfoot there?
Well, I mean, on that point, I think he aligns with what our point of view is at UCLM, because we're not for abolition of the police department either. You know, our point is the police could be doing their job much better, and the community should be more involved in the policing.
Right.
And mm-hmm. But we're not for eliminating it because it's an essential service. Someone needs to, when crimes happen, someone needs to show up, needs to investigate, and needs to find the perpetrators. So, you know, whatever you want to call them, it's going to end up being doing policing work. Someone's got to do it.
Let me bring in Kerry Coleman, Chair of Community Police Relations of UCLM. First of all, Kerry, thanks for making the time. What do you make of what you just heard from Councilmember Lightfoot?
Well, sir, I kind of concur with some of the things that Councilman Lightfoot is saying. Yes, I'm a firm stance that we should not abolish the police, but I'm also for basically revitalizing the police for the communities involved. We have to look at how we police in our communities. You know, what happened with Mr. Floyd in Minneapolis is just one of many things. We're policed in our communities because we're looked at as a certain way, okay? Now, I believe that there should be a national database for police officers that do misconduct, that they're not able to go to different other communities and do the same type of stuff. I believe in what Mayor Cuomo did with the 50A and basically, you know, bringing out the records of bad police officers and also able the community, because that empowers the community. Because right now in the black community, how we feel is basically we're being watched. It's almost like Gestapo tactics in a way. And I'm not trying to be radical in a way, because I believe there's men and women out there that save their life and risk their life every day out here in this community for us in this community. And I want these cops to be awarded as such forth. But we have a few bad apples in this group. So I have a saying that I say. If we have 1,020 cops and we got 20 bad cops, right, then we got 1,040 bad cops because they're not saying what these guys are doing, okay? I'm a veteran. I believe in law enforcement. But where we're going today in this country and what we've seen across this country is totally counterproductive for the image and also the community they're supposed to police.
Well, and I want to listen to one other comment, if we could, that comes from one of the four women who have been helping lead some of the public demonstrations in this community. On Friday on this program, Stanley Martin was on this program, and as a civil rights leader in this community, she talked about why they do have abolition on the table. Now, I mentioned to Stanley Martin that when you look at polling, which is complex and changing, I mean, the last thing I want to do is sort of oversimplify a complex issue. And one of the joys of this program is being able to talk at length about things that sometimes get oversimplified into sound bites. But if you look at polling right now in this country, there's not a single group of people from any background that supports abolition of police in any large number. There is a changing and strengthening support in the direction of defunding police when you define what that means. White Democrats, for example, that number is in the 40s that favor defunding police. Black Americans, 57% in a poll 2 weeks ago, say they favor defunding police. But that's, again, a little bit nebulous. Depends on what you mean by that. But I asked Stanley Martin, you know, if you favor abolition, as she says she does, is that out of step with what people tend to want to do when we see actual reform and change? And I want to listen to what she said.
I think defunding of police is one of the ways to eventually abolish the police. But I do think that because of how we are socialized or, in fact, colonized, we tend to think that we need different mechanisms to save us, like the police. But think about when it all started, right? We hear people are always afraid, people who live in neighborhoods with very minimal resources and scarcity. There's fear of violence. There's fear of, you know, being left to, you know, suffer from many different things. But I do think the answer is giving more resources to those communities to make the police obsolete.
Okay.
All right. So a lot there. Let me ask all three of you. Reverend Stewart, I'll start with you. Part of her point, and some of her colleagues have explained this in conversations with me as well, is that, yes, they acknowledge the polling. Most people, most Black Americans, don't support abolishing police right now. But their view is that a lot of people are sort of educated in what they view as kind of the detritus of a colonial system that teaches people, well, you need police.
Yeah.
And she believes that we don't, and at least as currently constructed. That is not what most people think, and you don't seem, Reverend Stewart, to have given up on the idea of policing. That's not to say that you don't want any changes. Obviously, you're making the call for change. But why do you think you, to the extent that maybe you disagree with some of the four women who have been leading these demonstrations, where do you see that disagreement taking root?
Well, I see the disagreement taking root in the fact that they are calling for the abolishment of the police department. Listen, we live in America. America has this romantic relationship with, number one, the gun. And that's why we have so many murders per capita in this country than we have anywhere else in the world. We have a lot of rapes here. There is just a lot of crime, and certainly there is some crime in communities of color. So therefore, we do need to police. I do not advocate the abolishment of the police. I advocate a re-envisioning and retraining of the police department, but not their abolishment. The abolishment of the police department is just out of step with communities of color. It's just totally out of step with it. And naturally, young people are going to talk that because they haven't lived long enough. They don't have the experience behind them. They don't have the wisdom. And neither do they have the vision, basically, of what communities should be. And it's not because of the fact of colonialism or neocolonialism. It has nothing to do with that. It's the fact is that if you abolish the police, what are you going to put in place of the police? You're certainly going to have another type of force that's going to have to deal with crime. So why not have the police that you have now better trained, non-biased, non-racist, to deal with the situations that we have to deal with? I mean, the police, they are an arm of government. We pay their taxes. Therefore, the community should have input in terms of what police should do and what we demand of police. So I just believe that certainly that type of stance is certainly out of coordination. It's not part of UCLM's vision at all.
Okay, Kerry Coleman.
Yeah, I wanted to say, I concur a little bit with what she's saying, but when you're talking about restructuring, I'm talking about the example. I'm going to give you an example of the RPD. At one point, 92% of the RPD officers on the RPD force lived outside the city of Rochester, okay? You have a disconnect with that, okay? Now it's down to about 88%. Now, when you look at a community and you have two different environments, that's going to be a disconnect. Okay, they don't. It's no communication. There's no type of interaction on the streets with the people that you police. So the people that you're policing look at you as an occupying force by looking at the behavior and some of the things that's going on out here. So what we have to do is improve that. All right. One of the things, and Reverend Stewart has talked about this, is this: when we have the new type of rookie coming out of the academy, we need to have a community board that basically also interviews these individuals that come into our community that's going to police. So if you come in here with this, you know, we're going to police everybody, fish in the barrel mentality, we don't need that in our community. But if you're going to come out here and say, hey, I want to get to know my neighbor, I want to get to know the people in my community that we police, and then you can alleviate a lot of this how can I say the correct word for it, this disconnect, okay, that we have today in our community.
Okay, Alex White.
Well, I'd like to see her plan. I mean, what is that going to look like? How are we going to step down to it? What are the phases that are going to lead there? Because and what is going to be there to deal with conflicts and problems and, you know, like everything else? I don't know. It's possible it could work. I'm skeptical, I'm very skeptical, but, you know, I want to see a plan, and what I hear is rhetoric. And I tend to feel that when there's only rhetoric, there's not, you know, that's not the way we should be headed.
All right, listeners, we're talking to members of United Christian Leadership Ministry who have been working on police community relations for many years. Reverend Lewis Stewart, Alex White is the co-chair of the Justice Advisory Board, Carrie Coleman, chair of Community Police Relations of UCLM, talking about how they see the change coming in this community. Weeks now of discussion, proposals, ideas, and as Reverend Stewart said, yes, weeks of that, but also that's coming on the backs of years of work that organizations like UCLM have put in, perhaps leading to the point of significant change. After our only break of the hour, we're going to get some of your feedback. I know listeners have questions about some of the other various and specific proposals out there, including qualified immunity for police and a whole lot of other ideas. So we'll take your phone calls, your emails, and much more with Reverend Stewart, Alex White, and Carrie Coleman next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, one of the wealthiest men in the country is the founder of Barstool Sports, and he says this week he cannot be canceled despite years of misogyny and racism. We're going to talk about the impact on American culture. Then in our second hour, public markets getting maybe more attention from shoppers who want to be outdoors. We'll talk about their plans for the warm weather months. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So let's go ahead and let's get some of the feedback from listeners who've been hearing the comments and the calls for different reforms. Bill in Seneca Falls is first. Go ahead, Bill.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just was wondering, you know, how the panel feels. I think one major issue that doesn't get talked about enough is that there's too many unneeded interactions with police in the community. And I just wondered how the panel felt about things like, you know, putting an end to laws against victimless crimes, such as, you know, drug possession and sex work, you know, and then on top of, you know, selling loose cigarettes, you know, and on top of that, you know, the issue of qualified immunity for police officers, you know, and the militarization of police forces. I feel like there's not enough talk about how many unnecessary interactions the community has with police over silly laws that the police should never be involved with in the first place. I'd love to hear what the panel says about that.
All right, Bill, thanks very much. So there's a general idea that too often there's interaction, and then there's three specific proposals he talked about, which I'll ask all of our guests to respond to. He's talking about the idea of ending qualified immunity, which just basically means if a police officer makes the kind of mistake or has an action that results in injury or death, that they can't get sued. Also, the war on drugs, he says, is essentially a series of victimless crimes, and there's a lot of evidence that the war on drugs has failed. And he's talking about militarization of police, in other words, the flow of tactical gear from the Pentagon to police departments. So those are three specific ideas. Reverend Stewart, are you on board with those ideas?
Yes, let me deal with them.
Yes.
One at a time.
Yep.
In terms of qualified immunity, I believe that cops should personally be sued. That way, if they are sued, this would be another restraint on them from going overboard when they tend to arrest people just for the sake of arresting them or the use of excessive force. I think that way, loosen the restraints relative to qualified immunity and having cops sued, I think that is a good way to go. I think it's a just way to go. The second thing is, I think some of the governor's reform bill addressed the fact of these arrests that are frivolous. So we need to really take a look at, do we want to really arrest people who have certain amounts of marijuana? Do we really want to look at arresting prostitutes who really commit nonviolent crimes? Do we really want to waste taxpayers' money doing that? I think those are some of the things that really bear scrutiny that we should really look at. And there was a third one you mentioned, Evan. I forgot what that third one was.
Tactical gear, war on drugs, and qualified immunity. So,
oh, yeah. Definitely relative to UCLM has been calling for the demilitarization of the police. The police were originally founded as a paramilitary group. And so it was made a way in which they could buy military surplus equipment. We don't need tanks going down Main Street and things of that sort. So if we're talking about defunding or reallocation of resources, then we're definitely talking about stop purchasing military equipment in an urban situation because it is not needed. However, if you view or if the police view the people in the community and police see them as an, and that's why people in the community see them as an occupying force because of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we really want true community policing, if we really want to establish some type of a trust and accountability, then let's stop buying the military equipment.
All right, Kerry.
I concur. I'm a veteran. I served two tours of combat. I don't see no need to alienate a community by having this type of equipment. Some of the police officers in tactical gear look no different than when I was a soldier in Iraq, okay, or Somalia. This is putting a bad message to the community. If you want to build up relations, then you need to get rid of that stuff. I see a police officer as a peace officer, not a person that's going to elevate or escalate a situation. And I concur with this caller. All the frivolous, like, arrests, and a lot of those arrests coming in poor, brown, and black communities, right? This reallocation of funds should be put into the infrastructure and rebuilding the community that we live in. If we take all the money, a third of the money that we use to allocate for this equipment, we can have parks rebuilt, job training for people that's coming out of incarceration. That's true rehabilitation. Now, the third one, that's going to be kind of catchy with that. You know, the unions control a lot of stuff that's going on, and they're giving a lot of the country the pushback. I think far as suing a police officer, that's great. But I think it should be taking another step with the district attorneys that get the people off the street and convict people wrongly and sometimes maliciously, right? They immunity should be lifted also, too, along with the judges. See, if we're going to do this on one level, we need to do this on multiple levels.
Alex White.
Once you start talking about qualified immunity, you've already moved beyond the question of you've moved to the point that you're admitting that we can't actually discipline the police. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, the fact that we're going to shift the responsibility of disciplining the police to people, in many cases poor people, to do lawsuits against them is not a solution. We need to step up and we need to actually create institutions and instruments that will effectively discipline and supervise police officers, and qualified
Definitely.
Immunity is kind of a weak way out of it. As for a lot of the crimes with drugs and prostitution, I think we need to find other ways to deal with those problems. And whether it's through training or drug treatment or other things, we've got to admit what the real problem is and deal with it that way, not as a criminal problem. And one of the things is the only tool we have at the moment is the police, and the only thing the police can do is arrest. So that's what they're doing. One of the ideas of redirecting funds would be to take some officers off the force and instead replace them with people who do outreach and drug treatment and try to get people into programs that would actually help them rather than throwing them in jail. And as for militarized equipment, you know, I'm the guy that doesn't even want the majority of officers to have guns. Military equipment seems outrageous, and I believe that we should have one of the largest garage sales in the planet getting rid of all that stuff.
Andrew emails the program to say, hi, Evan, I agree 100% with the panelist who said we need more of our police officers living in our city. If we are policed by outsiders, then we are truly living in an occupation zone. There could be incentives to have officers move in and stay living in our city, including stipulations for new hires, stipulations for promotions to higher positions within the department, and maybe financial aid, such as aid in obtaining a mortgage for a home in the city, end quote. That's from Andrew. Reverend Stewart, are you on board with that?
Yes, I'm certainly on board with that, but that's something that would have to gain the consent of the mayor and with city council. I think we need to give incentives, but even beyond that, the fact is, if you are hired as a police officer in the city, then the prerequisite, the requirement is that you are expected to live in the city or you will not get a job. Now, I know some of this has to go through the union and through state laws, et cetera, but certainly it needs to be changed in the right direction. And so, like Kerry had quoted, 93% of police officers in the RPD live outside the city. That needs to change. We need these officers living within the city, and therefore they will invest in the community in which they live, and they will begin to treat people differently as people.
All right. Well, Alex, Kerry, I mean, Kerry, do you think it's realistic to try to change these laws to increase the kind of aid? I mean, city council would have to figure out how to budget that, but could we get more officers living in the city, Kerry? We lost Kerry for a second. Well, let me have Alex White, and then we'll have are you back there, Kerry?
This is Alex. Let me chime in.
You're both there. Go ahead, Alex. Go ahead.
Okay.
There's a state law here. City council could offer incentives, but state law says that the officers that don't have to live there.
Right.
And it would be helpful if the state would recognize this problem and start making requirements to make it so that officers had to have some residency requirement, at the very least for any promotion whatsoever, and specifically, there should be an employment benefit to being a city resident.
Right.
Kerry, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I concur. But I think if we're talking about redistribution of funds, then the math is easy. If we use this incentive to bring more minority officers, more officers to live in our city, more officers that care about our community, so all we do is redistribute the funds. If we use less tactical gear and more practical gear for our community, then we wouldn't have a lot of these issues that's going on. You know, the caller is right. If you go into city court on a Monday morning at 9 o'clock when they open their doors and you look at the people that's coming from the back over the weekend, 85 to 90% of those people are going to be people of color, right? Let's say 70% of those charges is going to be drug charge or some type of gun charge, right? So this is the things that we need to look at, right? So if we talk about redistribution of funds, we need to look at it that way and how we need to alleviate that aspect in our community.
I got an email from a retired police commander who writes that we are much closer on this than many people think. Many police officers and managers would love to have more social services available as a resource. There is a solution. We can get this done, and I'm actually excited. And goes on to say, state law requires deputies to live in the county they work in. Why not localities? So much of this can get done. That's from a police commander. Let me get Laura in Rochester next. Go ahead, Laura.
Hi, I just had a quick question. Why have we hired more diverse police officers in our community to alleviate some of this?
Okay, that's an important question, Laura, so thank you. I appreciate that. So,
I want to add to that.
Yeah, I'd like all three of you to jump in. So there's two parts of this I'd like you to address if you could. Number one, I don't have all of the numbers in front of me when it comes to the actual breakdown of the police department in terms of background. I know the effort has, there's been an ongoing effort to build a more diverse force. There's also some concern that says it matters, but it's not the be-all, end-all. Some of it's a culture issue, and that there has to be, you know, training and culture within departments, no matter the racial makeup. So there's a lot there, and I'll ask all three of you, Reverend Stewart, if you want to start, go ahead.
Yes, let me start first with that. UCLM has been working with a lot of the chiefs in the county, specifically in terms of recruitment. And Alex and Kerry knows this. Their main concerns is the fact that not too many people of color are joining police force. And I think that's because, number one, the negative image of policing. That's number one. Number two, the fact that, rightly so, it's a dangerous job. So therefore, they have to spread their wings out a little further into other cities to try and get more people of color in recruiting relative to policing. So I know that, for example, Irondequoit does not have that many black officers, and maybe just one or two, and so does Greece. So that it's been a very difficult job. They've tried recruiting at every level and things of that sort. They managed to get maybe about one or two persons, but certainly it's not enough to fill that requirement. And so it's very difficult, especially in these dismal times that we live in, really to throw out a bait or a hook, as you would say, to try and get more black and brown police officers. The other thing I wanted to mention is the fact that policing is very difficult and hard work. And so we have to offer, I think, other incentives in order to get the kinds of officers that we want involved in policing. The other thing is, and let me mention this, the other thing is the culture of policing. Sometimes black officers will, and I'm not saying in this community, but in other communities, sometimes black officers will just sit there or stand there while a white officer mistreats a person of color instead of putting that person on the carpet. And in one sense, when a black officer becomes a police officer, he becomes blue. And so he buys into that overall protective culture of policing in which anything goes. And that policing culture is what we need to dismantle, is what we need to break up and really try to plant seeds of new thinking and new attitudes with new behavior.
Okay, Kerry Coleman.
Yeah. So you got to think about going back to what I said earlier about when you go into city court on Monday,
you
see some of these people, right? And you see them coming in there, and it's black and brown individuals. The standards are as getting police officers. You might have destroyed an individual that might want to be a leader in this community as a police officer. You know, you give them a bad taste. And this is why the relationship needs to be built, because I think part of that problem is this. When you change the image on how you look in your community, then you want to be like that community, okay? Most black men don't want to be police officers in our community. Let's just be straight up with that, all right?
True.
Because,
yep.
Because of the image that's been portrayed through generations, you know, from that point. Now, another thing that we need to look at, too, also is if we're going to bring officers in our community, right, to live with all these incentives, we also need to get the community involved on who hires the officers to be in our community. It's nothing wrong with having a community board that interviews officers that come out of the academy to see where their mindset at. And another thing, as a veteran, if this is a dangerous job, I'm a firm believer that every 6 months that an officer in a high-risk environment must take a psychological evaluation. And that's what I have to say about it.
Okay, Alex.
Evan,
go ahead.
Evan, before Alex chimes in, just let me say this. Let me give you a brief example. When city council was holding those hearings, maybe about a year or so ago, relative to the Police Accountability Board, the city council chambers were packed out with a lot of black police officers, as well as the majority white police officers. And all of them were haranguing people, including black officers as well as white, who spoke out in favor of the PAB. And that's why I'm talking about the fact that that police culture needs to be dismantled. And when a black cop becomes a cop, he takes on the color of blue. And there's no difference between the white cop and the black cop.
All right, Alex White.
The way we're presently policing and the predominance of charges and incidents between young black people in an urban community really does eliminate statistically more than a third of the potential people that could be recruited into the police department because they end up with some minor criminal charge. And, you know, if we really want to increase the number of people of color in the police department, we've got to start by changing the way we police so that we are no longer creating or fulfilling this this school to prison pipeline by getting people in their teens charges.
All right.
I want to add to that if I could.
Yes.
Okay, because you can look at, I'm just using Rochester as an example. I'm originally from Detroit, Michigan. I moved here in 96 after I retired from the military. But one of the things that I see, it was the, like Alex said, was the king of our school district, okay? And that should go hand in hand. You know, when you look at the surrounding school districts around here, right, they don't have officers like we have in our schools. And one of the things I want to applaud the city council is by taking out those officers because you're creating an environment of hate, okay? Because you're bringing that same thing that you got to deal with every day when you leave the school into the school, okay? Now, if we have officers in here that's unarmed, that's in there in their uniform, and they're here to be a peace officer, then that's more of an advancement than someone we see in there in a gun that you have to see everything, a weapon, excuse me, that you see every day walking home from school. Now, if we're going to put police officers in our school, they're going to be enrichment-type officers to help kids along. That's going to be there if a kid is in trouble. It's not going to step in as a cop, but step in as a leader. This is the type of stuff we need to look at, you know, far as improving how we improve on our recruitment and also our black and brown males and also women in our school district.
All right, let me get one more phone call. This is Willa in Rochester. Go ahead, Willa.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Evan. This has been a really enlightening conversation. Talking about police officers in our schools, you know, that started with a program in the late 90s that was federally funded grant, matching grant to cities. And so, you know, police officers were placed in our schools with little to no input from the school board of the mid-90s. After that federal grant money dried up, the city continued to fund it was called the Cops in Schools program. And it wasn't until about 2006 that the city decided they didn't want to pay for that anymore and made the shift. Well, by then, the conversation about police officers in schools was happening all over the state and country. We had Columbine, we had Sandy Hook. And so the idea of backing away from police officers in our schools in the face of that national conversation was really intimidating. Even so, we've been having that conversation on the city school board for a number of years. And the convergence of events has been tremendous in terms of being able to have a conversation, not just here in Rochester, but all over the country, about a new social compact. And in the absence of a new social compact, that would have been very difficult to turn around and say, okay, we're not going to do cops in schools. There was enormous pressure from everywhere, teachers and parents saying, no, those cops in the schools are keeping our kids safe. They're keeping our teachers safe.
No.
We have a perfect opportunity to build an entirely new social compact, and we cannot afford to waste it.
Well, and Willa, thank you for the phone call. And on that note, there's about 90 seconds left here. With that call in mind to create a new social compact, Reverend Stewart, what's next for UCLM? What are you working on right now?
Well, we're working on a couple things. Let me say that on July 9th at 6:30 p.m. at the First Church of God, 334 Clarissa Street, it's going to be, the event will be held outside. There will be a community discussion on race, policing, and solutions. We have different panelists coming, Chief LaRon Singletary, Mike Mazzio, Leticia Astacio, Kerry Coleman, among others, who will be speaking on this issue. And mainly we're going to be talking about solutions. The other three things that we are definitely working on, we're definitely working on racial justice and education training curriculum. Also, the community public safety panel, wherein 3 to 5 people will be appointed to interview police before they become police officers. And then a mandated mental health evaluation annually. And also the expanded governor's executive order relative to independent investigations of police use of excessive force. Also, we're working on a summit that'll be here on next year that we're working on. So we're doing, UCLM is doing a number of things relative to try to bridge this gap relative to police mistrust and suspicion, and bring people together. So not only that we discuss stuff, but we've been discussing stuff for years. What we really need to look at is how we want to envision our community.
Reverend Stewart, on July 9th, again, the time and the place.
6:30 p.m., July 9th at First Church of God, 334 Clarissa Street. It'll be held on the outside.
That's next week. Reverend Stewart, I want to say to you, I'm glad you reached out to me. I will reach out to you before too long, because I always appreciate your voice, and I look forward to the time when I can see you in person again soon, sir.
Yes, same here, Evan. Thank you.
Reverend Lewis Stewart, Alex White, Kerry Coleman, thanks to both of you as well. And
here's
hoping we can continue these conversations. Thanks to all three of you. They're joining us from the United Christian Leadership Ministry. Many more conversations to come on the subject of police reform. Rob Braden is the engineer, Megan Max the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. It's the second of our only 2 days of a membership campaign. I hope you're a member and you've called 454-6300. We'll talk to you tomorrow.